We're going to read from Psalm 31 tonight. Lord willing, next week we're going to start a series in the evening from the book of Acts. And frankly, Psalm 31 is basically me buying time. It's hard to start a new book. There's a lot of work that you need to do. And I needed another week to get into Acts. And so with that in mind, I wanted to go back to this psalm. And in the interest of full disclosure, this isn't a new sermon. A few of you have heard this before, and a couple of you have heard it twice in different forms, which is okay, because this is a passage that I go over a lot. In particular, our focus is going to be verses 14 and 15. There's this beautiful expression of faith that David gives us in these two verses. And I don't think they're that familiar. Verse 5 of Psalm 31 is a familiar verse, one that we hear Jesus repeating on the cross. But verses 14 and 15, I don't think are all that familiar, but they're really helpful. An encouragement to us to know where to find confidence, even in the midst of difficulty. And so I want to read the whole thing. I do think verses 14 and 15 are somewhat of a climax in the psalm, intentionally in the middle, centered there to give it some rooting and foundation. But it's good to see those in the whole context. So I'll go ahead and read the whole thing. And just a reminder that this is God's word, and so we should pay careful attention to it. Psalm 31. In you, O Lord, do I take refuge. Let me never be put to shame. In your righteousness, deliver me. Incline your ear to me. Rescue me speedily. Be a rock of refuge for me, a strong fortress to save me. For you are my rock and my fortress. And for your name's sake, you lead me and guide me. You take me out of the net they have hidden for me. For you are my refuge. Into your hand I commit my spirits. You have redeemed me, O Lord, faithful God. I hate those who pay regard to worthless idols, but I trust in the Lord. I will rejoice and be glad in your steadfast love, because you have seen my affliction. You have known the distress of my soul, and you have not delivered me into the hand of the enemy. You have set my feet in a broad place. Be gracious to me, O Lord, for I am in distress. My eye is wasted from grief. My soul and my body also, for my life is spent with sorrow and my years with sighing. My strength fails because of my iniquity, and my bones waste away. Because of all my adversaries, I have become a reproach, especially to my neighbors, and an object of dread to my acquaintances. Those who see me in the street flee from me. I have been forgotten like one who is dead. I become like a broken vessel, for I hear the whispering of many, terror on every side, as they scheme together against me, as they plot to take my life. But I trust in you, O Lord. I say, you are my God. My times are in your hand. Rescue me from the hand of my enemies and from my persecutors. Make your face shine on your servant. Save me in your steadfast love. O Lord, let me not be put to shame, for I call upon you. Let the wicked be put to shame. Let them go silently to Sheol. Let the lying lips be mute, which speak insolently against the righteous in pride and contempt. Oh, how abundant is your goodness, which you have stored up for those who fear you and worked for those who take refuge in you, in the sight of the children of mankind. In the cover of your presence, you hide them from the plots of men. You store them in your shelter from the strife of tongues. Blessed be the Lord, for he has wondrously shown his steadfast love to me when I was in a besieged city. I had said in my alarm, I am cut off from your sight. But you heard the voice of my pleas for mercy when I cried to you for help. Love the Lord, all you his saints. The Lord preserves the faithful, but abundantly repays the one who acts in pride. Be strong and let your heart take courage, all you who wait for the Lord. Thus ends the reading of God's perfect word. This is an interesting psalm for a variety of reasons. One thing about it that I think is interesting is that Jesus would quote from this psalm on the cross. And I find that interesting mostly because it's not a familiar psalm to us. We don't find ourselves in Psalm 31 all that often. And yet, there we have those words in verse 5, into your hand I commit my spirit, and we know them. We just don't know where they're from in the Old Testament. But it's also an interesting psalm because David changes up his patterns a little bit in how he structures this psalm. There are various types of psalms. Psalms of praise, obviously, like Psalm 35 that we began with. There are psalms of wisdom, like Psalm 1 that calls us to the path of righteousness. And there is something called a psalm of lament. You'll recognize those. Something like Psalm 13. How long, O Lord, will you forget me? Now, psalms of lament have a particular pattern to them in that it usually begins by talking about how bad things are and asking questions about when will God act. And then it ends with the psalmist remembering God's faithfulness. What's interesting about Psalm 31 is that there is some pieces of it that sound like a psalm of lament. Verses 9 through 13, which we're going to look at in a minute, I think are the verses that cause Jesus to call this particular psalm to mind. It sounds like the struggles that Jesus would have on his way to the cross. But what's interesting is, unlike most psalms of lament, the lament is in the middle. And on either side of it, David gives praise to God. Which, if you think about it, is unusual. Not just because of the Psalms, but it's not how we work. We don't begin by talking about how great and wonderful the Lord is. He describes him as my rock and my fortress. And yet then he turns and describes the ways that God has forgotten him and allowed difficulty to come to him. And then he turns again in confidence to God and gives praise to him. Just think it's interesting how he designs and organizes the psalm, and it tells us something about how to respond to those times in our lives when there is difficulty. And right in the middle, in verse 14, after this, these verses of lament describing the difficulty of his position, David then responds in faith. And listen to how confident he is in the promises of God. But I trust in you, O Lord. I say, you are my God. My times are in your hand. Now, there's three things in particular that David focuses on, and that's really what I want us to focus on, are these three pillars that give David confidence, even in the midst of affliction. There's a reason, by the way, that sermons have this three-part pattern to them, even though a lot of mine don't. The design of it is that the number three is important, of course, and there's even, it seems to be, a design and structure in the way that God creates the world of the importance of three. Obviously, we have the Trinity, but think about it even, and I'm glad Gerard's not here because I'm not an engineer, but I'm going to delve into this for a little bit. I mean, what's the strongest structure when you're building something? What's the shape that you use to create strength in a structure? A triangle, right? Three sides. stronger than a square. Yeah, I see David looking up. We have triangles above us holding up the roof so it doesn't fall on our head, right? It's a triangle. And that's something of what David's doing here. Not necessarily thinking of a triangle, but he's giving us three things that should give us confidence, that should cause us to bear up in a strong way in the midst of affliction. And those three things are here in verses 14 through 15. First of all, but I trust in you, O Lord. Faith. Faith in the Lord. Secondly, and again in verse 14, he says, I say, you are my God. And it seems to me what David's doing here is focusing on the covenant. I will be your God and you will be my people. David's claiming the covenant because it's what gives him confidence so that he can trust in God, because God is faithful to his covenant promises. And then finally, in verse 15, he says, my times are in your hand. He's not only a faithful God, he's not only a covenant God, but he's a sovereign God. So that everything that happens, all of our circumstances, are in the hands of God. And that's what I think is so remarkable, and why this psalm has stuck in my head over the past couple years, is there's a simplicity to these two verses, and yet David provides for us these three things: faith, covenant, and sovereignty. And in these things of God, we have hope of remaining upright when we face affliction. And we'll begin with the first of these things, faith. I want us to look at the content and structure of the psalm just a little bit to give us an idea of what David's doing. David apparently wrote this psalm during a time of distress. Look back again at verses 9 through 13 as he describes his circumstances as he writes. Be gracious to me, O Lord, for I am in distress. My eye is wasted from grief. My soul and my body also, for my life is spent with sorrow and my years with sighing. My strength fails because of my iniquity and my bones waste away. Notice that, by the way, in verse 10. My strength fails because of my iniquity. It's not saying, woe is me, how could you do this to me? He understands that his suffering and his struggles have something to do with sin and that he's a sinner. And so he's weighed down not just by outside forces, but by his own iniquity, so that his bones waste away. He goes on to say in verse 11, because of all my adversaries, I have become a reproach, especially to my neighbors, and an object of dread to my acquaintances. Those who see me in the street flee from me. I have been forgotten like one who is dead. I've become like a broken vessel. And then listen to verse 13. For I hear the whispering of many, terror on every side, as they scheme together against me, as they plot to take my life. This is the center of this psalm of confidence. These terrible circumstances, his life even threatened as people plot against him, whispering in his ear about the terror that is about to be unleashed on him. And yet, in the midst of those circumstances, he begins and ends his psalm in prayer and praise, confident in the promises of God. And though he writes in a circumstance that would understandably bring lamentation, David focuses more on the faithfulness of God. So that this is more a psalm of trust or confidence than a psalm of lament. He begins and ends with expressions of faith and trust and hope. Verse 5, he says, into your hand I commit my spirits. The same words that Jesus spoke from the cross. Jesus speaking those words with the context of Psalm 31, certainly in his mind. It fits his experience, doesn't it? My eye is wasted from grief. My soul and my body is wasted. My life is spent with sorrow. My years with sighing. My strength is failing. My bones are wasting away. I'm a reproach, an object of dread to my acquaintances. Those who see me in the street flee from me? People whispering, and not just whispering, but mocking, screaming, and spitting on him. Terror on every side as they scheme against Jesus, taking his life from him. And it's in the midst of that persecution, at the point of his death, that Jesus turns over his life to the purposes of God. Into your hand I commit my spirit. He trusts his Father with the preservation of his spirit in life and in death. That's for us Christians on this side of the cross reading Psalm 31, what we should have in mind. Not just David. David provides a dim reflection of what Jesus encounters on his way to the cross. But we should have in mind Jesus himself and his holy confidence in the Father, even as he marches to the cross according to the will of his Father. His enemies have seemingly taken everything from him, his health, his strength, his reputation, and soon his life. But there was one thing that no one could take from Jesus. And there's one thing that no one could take from David. Confidence in the Almighty God. Listen to what Matthew Henry says about this particular portion of Psalm 31. His enemies, he says, robbed him of his reputation among men, but they could not rob him of his comfort in God, because they could not drive him from his confidence in God. They could never take that from him. God is faithful. And therefore David could say, despite increasing persecution and the threat of death, into your hand I commit my spirit. And Jesus himself, even at the point of death on a cross, could say the same. That's what we find in verse 14. Great confidence in God because he is faithful. Resting in the sovereignty of God because he knows his promises to be true. And it provides in the psalm a turning point. After a list of laments that could certainly produce hopelessness, the psalmist turns the whole mood of the psalm by saying, I trust in you, O Lord. Armed with every reason to give up hope for despair, David responds in faith. He trusts in the Lord. And then the psalmist goes on to describe two reasons for this confident faith. First, he takes confidence in the covenant faithfulness of God. And not just in his covenant, the covenant faithfulness of God, but in his own personal covenant relationship with God. Notice what he says in verse 14. But I trust in you, O Lord. I say, you are my God. Now, David says words like this often. You are my God. I'm not sure that we fully appreciate what he's communicating in these words. It's a pretty simple sentence. But it's filled with important meaning for the Christian. It's an expression of faith, but it's also an understanding of who God is. And it's an understanding of who we are in relationship to God. There's a real sense of commitment in these words. And it's a commitment that flows in both directions, both God to us and us to God. Think about it. In contrast with the nations surrounding Israel, as David writes, the nations surrounding Israel are filled with people devoted to the worship of many gods. And in fact, devoted to the worship of as many gods as they can find who might be useful to them when they need them. They have very little commitment even to their plethora of national gods. They're willing to go worship the gods of other nations if it will serve their purposes and serve their good. Think about Jonah in the boat as that storm is shaking them and everybody stops what they're doing and they worship whatever god they serve. Except for Jonah, right? Who won't worship God because he knows that that means submitting to God. And so they're worshiping every god they can think of. And one of the sailors comes to Jonah and says, what are you doing? Why aren't you worshiping your God? Do you see what that communicates? The sailor who worships other gods from pagan nations is willing to worship Jonah's God if that will bring an end to the storm. No commitment. Whatever God will serve his purposes and save his skin. Doesn't discriminate. David's not like that. You are my God. He cries to one God because he knows there's only one God and only one true God. And so he expresses exclusive reliance on the covenant faithfulness of his God. And isn't it interesting? He doesn't say, you are our God. In other words, you're not the God of Israel. You're my God. It's not simply the God of the nation of Israel. This is the covenant God. Even notice the word he uses, first of all, but I trust in you, O Lord, all capital letters, Yahweh, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, who made a covenant and who made promises in that covenant and who always keeps those promises. And now David claims that God as his own. There's a personal connection, a personal commitment that unites David to his God. This is more than an impersonal force. Here was a God with whom David could talk directly. In fact, that's exactly what he does in verse 14. He speaks these words not as some impersonal expression or even as a profession before other people, but he pronounces this confidence to God himself. You, the Lord of the heavens and the earth, the one who was and is to come, you are my God. David establishes a pattern, and it's a pattern that can empower our prayers. How often do we open our prayers with impersonal expressions of God's majesty? You are great. You're good. Mighty. You created all things. Those are all good ways to open prayer. But how often do we do like David, who cuts right to the chase and says, I'll call out to you because you're my God. I will be your God, and you will be my people. And David claims that covenant promise. My adversaries have made me a reproach to my neighbors, an object of reproach to my acquaintances. Those who see me in the street flee from me, but no matter what others might testify about me, I have an unwavering certainty that you are my God and that you will not turn your face from me. You will never fail me. You will never forsake me. David does something similar at the beginning of the psalm. He begins by saying, in you, O Lord, do I take refuge. Let me never be put to shame. In your righteousness, deliver me. Incline your ear to me, rescue me speedily, be a rock of refuge for me, a strong fortress to save me. And then he claims those things, for you are my rock and my fortress. And for your name's sake, you lead me and guide me. David claims the covenant promises of God. He'll pray for rescue, he'll pray for restoration, and he'll pray for deliverance. But before he does any of that, he simply expresses confidence in God, that he's faithful and that he's made promises. But then finally, David, in his prayer, reflects on the sovereignty and providence of God. My times are in your hand. And back a couple years ago in this psalm, when God used this psalm to direct my attention in certain ways, it was that phrase that grabbed me. My times are in your hand. Did you notice something strange about that expression? It almost seems to be a typographical error, like there was an S added. He doesn't say my time is in your hand. My times, plural, are in your hand. And that's what I've spent the last couple years just turning over in my head. Why does he use the plural? What does it teach us? It seems as if he's focusing on how different his circumstances are. And yet, God is the same. And that God is sovereign when things go badly, and God is sovereign when things go well. And that I can know that. In fact, it seems as if that's partially why he can speak with such confidence in verse 14, because he knows God in this way. That he's not just Lord over the good things that happen, but he's Lord over the bad things. And that I can be joyful in good circumstances and bad circumstances because my God never changes. Calvin writes it this way. He says, "The variety of causalities by which the life of man is usually harassed, that God is Lord over all of them." At the moment that he wrote this psalm, King David found himself in a time of trial and difficulty. He was surrounded on every side by enemies seeking his life. That's pretty normal in the life of David, right? He's chased by Saul, he's chased by his sons, he's chased by other nations. But David also knew times of joy and satisfaction. He was able to conquer Jerusalem and to carry the ark into the city and to dance and sing before the Lord because he knew that God had done it. He was able to see his kingdom expand as God showed his blessing to the nation of Israel. And what David does in verse 15, what he cinches with this phrase, is that his confident faith in the covenant God doesn't depend on circumstances or situations. All of his times, hard and easy, long or short, bitter or sweet, all of his times are in the hand of the sovereign, faithful covenant God. You remember the words from Ecclesiastes 3, verses 1 through 8? Because I think Solomon's saying the same thing. "For everything there's a season and a time for every matter under heaven, a time to be born and a time to die, a time to plant and a time to pluck up what is planted, a time to kill and a time to heal, a time to break down and a time to build up, a time to weep and a time to laugh, a time to mourn and a time to dance, a time to cast away stones and a time to gather stones together, a time to embrace and a time to refrain from embracing, a time to seek and a time to lose, a time to keep and a time to cast away, a time to tear and a time to sow, a time to keep silence and a time to speak, a time to love and a time to hate, a time for war and a time for peace." And then in verse 11, it says, "He has made everything beautiful in its time." And isn't that what David's telling us as well? The Lord makes everything beautiful in its time, for no situation stands outside of God's good purposes for his people. David learned this truth through a difficult history. And you can think maybe of the time in the cave when an army of 3,000 soldiers was pursuing him. King Saul enters the cave and has no idea that David's there. And his companions tell him, "This is your time." But David won't touch Saul. He leaves it to the Lord to judge. He knows himself to be the anointed and knows that in God's good timing, he will put him on the throne. David knew what it meant to put his times and his circumstances in the hand of the Lord and to wait for the Lord to bring to pass his good providence in the life of David. And so he waited patiently, faithfully, knowing the goodness of God who is faithful, sovereign, and good. And that's what He calls us to do as well. I wanted to close in the book of Philippians. Paul builds on this idea in Philippians 4. First of all, in Philippians 4, verses 4 through 7, he says, "Rejoice in the Lord always. Again, I will say rejoice. Let your reasonableness be known to everyone. The Lord is at hand. Do not be anxious about anything, but in everything, by prayer and supplication with thanksgiving, let your requests be made known to God. And the peace of God, which surpasses all understanding, will guard your hearts and your minds in Christ Jesus." This is Paul's response to the faithfulness of God. He's displayed it in Jesus Christ, in his death and resurrection, providing salvation and a secure place in the presence of God for all eternity. He has peace with God so that he can rejoice in every circumstance. And then Paul goes on in verse 11 to say this: "Not that I'm speaking of being in need, for I've learned in whatever situation I am to be content. I know how to be brought low, and I know how to abound. In any and every circumstance, I have learned the secret of facing plenty and hunger, abundance and need." And what's the secret? "I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me." And isn't that in some ways the flowering of the confidence of David? Because this covenant God showed himself to be faithful in Christ. So that we, worshiping the same God, can have great confidence in the faithfulness of God because he's accomplished salvation. And we can know him to be a faithful covenant God because he sent his Son to do everything that he promised to do. And we can take great confidence in all of our circumstances because God doesn't change, even as our circumstances change. Matthew Henry summed it up in this way. He said, "If God has our times in his hand, he can help us. And if he be our God, he will help us. And then what can discourage us? My times are in your hand. You are my God, and in you I trust."